Hi everybody and welcome back to the Agility Rose Talk and Train podcast. So before we get started, I would like to thank our sponsors Nailer Agility for their support. If you haven't heard of Nailer before, they're the UK's leading tunnel providers. They have a product for everyone with complete customization when purchasing from them. You can choose between heavy and lightweight, agility or hoopers spec, and much more. Each tunnel is flexible, durable, and suitable for indoor and outdoor use. Nailer have just launched their new Non-Slip Plus tunnels, which is an excellent product for our dog safety. The new Non-Slip Plus agility tunnels are constructed using a new, highly textured material, and the inside of the tunnel has a heavy textured finish and offers significantly more grip. Nailer have very kindly sent me a new Non-Slip Plus tunnel to trial for myself, which will be put to the test by my dogs. If you're interested in hearing more or want to learn about how I'm finding their new tunnel, please feel free to contact me via Instagram at Agility Rose. And without further ado, let's get into this episode. Thanks, guys. So yeah, so to get started, I always like to do an introduction. So for anyone that doesn't know you, I'd be surprised if they didn't, because as you've had such a fantastic career in agility so far in the UK and abroad internationally. But if you could introduce yourself, your dogs, how long you've been in agility for, and what your favourite agility achievement to date is.
Okay, hi there. So I've been competing 14 years.
Wow.
I thought it was longer than that, but I've only been competing 14 years. I actually started, this is the bit that people may not know, I only came into agility because I was on a TV programme, Dog Borstal.
Wow.
Years ago, yeah. So I had a rescue beagle that was the worst case they saw. I saw, this is how I know Rob Elaine, who helped me with Zippy. He was the behaviourist I saw. So basically, this beagle was just everything you said would do the opposite. It wouldn't go out, wouldn't come back in, jumped up at you, ran away, and all this sort of thing. And so I've had dogs before, but I've never had anything like this before, nothing. So anyway, I went on the program and he suggested that the dog really needed working and suggested obedience. And I came away and I started doing obedience. And through that, I tried working trials. And through that, I tried agility, and that I was hooked. As soon as I was in agility, that was it. So that's how I actually got into agility in the first place. And I got a spaniel Dime. Everybody knows Dime.
Yeah.
Well, my trainer at the time, Lisa, she had seven dogs, and I thought I was being sensible. I got Phaser, my Labrador, and then a few months later, Dime came along, and then a few months after that, I got Twiggy, another cocker spaniel.
Oh.
I know. And then I thought I was being sensible, stopping there. But I had three puppies I trained up. So it was very challenging, a real eye-opener. So that's how I started agility. And since then, I've had Rival, because I love running dogs of all heights. They're different challenges, but it's important because they're my pets as well, that they have like fun personality. So I won't just get any large dog. It has to be something, you know, because they're your pets too, that you can live with.
Yeah. Oh, God,
yeah. Yeah. So Rival, Border Collie came along. And then I've had, you know, I've got Zelda, Cocker Spaniel. She's quite hard to train. She's lovely as a pet, but we don't gel in the agility field. She doesn't run very well for me. She'd rather look after me, but she runs amazing for the people. Oh. And Ninja Zippy I've got as well. And Crash.
And Crash, the beautiful Crash, what I must say. He's gorgeous.
Yeah, he's 4 years old. So, they're all my, those are the dogs that I've been doing agility with. I've trained other people's, like Jack Russells and things, and all sorts of different breeds. But those are the dogs I have at the moment. And my favourite, I would say my favourite ever has to be, I mean, I've got lots of experiences that are amazing, like making up an agility champion or even winning your first ticket. Your first round, it's so special. But for me, the one that gave me the biggest goosebumps, the biggest smile, has to be when Zippy ran at Crufts after the previous time not running at all at Crufts, like so freaked out, so scared. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't ever my goal to get her to run at Crufts. It was just so amazing that she did. I just wanted her super confident, you know. Mm-hmm. But for her to be so happy, and that seemed to be such a big obstacle for so long, and suddenly she just looked amazing. That to me was the best ever, I think.
Oh, bless her. And such a huge achievement. I remember seeing that first year and then her coming back the next year, and the difference was incredible what you'd gone and worked on with her. She was just so, like you say, so happy, and that means more than any ribbon or anything like that, didn't it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it was quite a journey because it was the same year that we went to the European Champs. So I think, was it March? Crufts is on. She mm-hmm. wouldn't run. And that's the first time she did that. That was brand new for me. Mm-hmm. And then is it July? That was the European Champs. And she ran amazing. She came fifth in the final.
So incredible.
It's been a real up and down journey. And it has been. And it's, I think some people think it was a magic fix. It really isn't. And I never said ever that she was fixed. There's mm-hmm. always going to be, like, it's the same as a human, isn't it? When things worry or scare you, there's times when it will come back, and then there are other times when you're feeling super confident again.
Yeah, oh god, yeah, 100%. And I think that'll be really helpful to have your kind of perspective on that for some of these questions, because it's, I think, especially obviously this episode being about spaniels, they do have those sensitivities, and it does come in waves and stuff. So we had tons of questions sent in. I couldn't believe I was inundated on this one. So question one, what would you advise or warn someone about when they're considering getting a cocker spaniel for the first time?
Oh wow. Well, the first thing I'd ask them is what they want and why. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, Cocker Spaniels, I mean, I'm assuming you're talking about working Cocker Spaniels.
Yes.
Working Cocker Spaniels, I call them Pandora's box. That's why I love them. Yeah. They're just so different. You can have, you know, you'll have people that say, go get a Cocker Spaniel. They're great because mine just lies down all day and it's so easy. But then you'll have others that are like monkeys and they climb the furniture and they really test your patience. Yeah. And that's what I love about them. So I'd have to ask the person, like, why do you want them? It's crazy because when I first started, there was very few Cocker Spaniels doing agility. Mm. And I remember when I started, people came up to me, because I didn't know, I just came in with dive, and everyone came up to me and went, why would you get a Cocker Spaniel? All they do is sniff.
Really?
Yeah. And I didn't even know that they did that. So in a way, ignorance is bliss, because I came in with, you know, dive was grade one. So it wasn't something I had to watch out for because I didn't know. Mm. Yeah, and it's amazing that right now, like, all the classes are full of spaniels. Like, what a turnaround. Yeah. And they're seen as a threat. They're seen as a competitive edge, which is amazing because they weren't at the beginning.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, every queue I think this weekend I've been in, there was at least, in a queue of 10, there was at least, what I would say, about five of them were at least spaniels, probably more than that, in fact.
Yeah.
When I was queuing for ABC, I think at the time it was just all spaniels in my queue.
So I love it. It really makes me smile because they were a breed that, you know, not everyone, but it was the biggest consensus of opinion was, no, why would you do that?
Wow, I never knew that, because I came in when they were probably getting quite popular. I came in 2014, so it would sort of started to spur on a little bit since then. But I had no idea they were such a kind of uncommon breed at the start. Wow.
It's just, this is going back a long time. But yeah, there was a couple of people that were really successful. But really it wasn't, So, and I just love my gun dogs. I mean, I've had gun dogs all my life. Labrador, so that's why I went for a spaniel. I didn't see anybody compete because I started with grade one. My trainer, she had collies and Jack Russell. So the biggest thing I say to people now is you know, research your lines, because different I find looking at the pedigrees, I think it's important to, if you look at working cross spaniels, sort of know their lines a little bit.
It gives you
a good start, I think, and you can see sort of, like, there's certain lines I understand. Not always, obviously, it's just, you know, you always get your anomalies, but on the whole, there's certain lines that are well known for being a bit hard hunters, as they say in the field trial world, a bit fast, a bit, you know, quick on the, and therefore they can be very intelligent and hard to live with, you know, could be. I'm not saying they are, if you don't address what they need in their life. There's others that are really quite relaxed, loyal, very brave, and some that are known for being a bit I'm not going to say sensitive because that's not right, mm-hmm. but aware of the environment more than others.
Yeah.
Also,
yeah,
I would say that.
Oh God, yeah, and I think, like you said, it's a good point highlighting there that, you know, a lot of our breeders in the UK use still Gundog lines, and obviously yeah. they're being bred for the Gundog purpose and using their nose, so kind of being aware of what lines you're looking into and what those dogs are being bred for, I think that's super important. And that leads quite nicely onto our next one, actually, question wise, which is what are your favorite spaniel lines and what advice would you give to someone when they're researching breeders?
I'll be honest, this is personal preference, honestly. Because there's some cracking lines out there. And to be honest, the Spaniel gene pool is tiny. So they all kind of go back really to probably about 5 lines. It's crazy how small the gene pool really is, if you look at any pedigree. But my favourite has to be Mysie. I can't pronounce it very well because it's a Welsh word. Mysie Derwin. I think, yeah, Mysie Derwin.
Yep. Yep.
That's one of my favourite lines. I think they're the hardest to live with personally. Mm-hmm. But I love the challenge. My other favourite is I love Tim's Gary. I'm not convinced they make the best agility dogs. I mean, I know Dimer's Tim's Gary lines, but agility's moved on now and they can be quite heavier set. I mean, I love them, but they're very bold and they're very powerful. But I don't know if Dime had his day when he was around and he was amazing. I don't know if he'd be as competitive now, the way agility's moved on. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm so lucky when he was there, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah, I know what you mean. I was only saying the same thing about my previous dog to compare if she was here now. How competitive, I mean, medium is just, it's a league of its own now. It's just incredible. The competition in that height now is insane. And I was saying how my spaniel, if he'd have come out when she came out, he probably would be grade 7 by now. But because of the level of the dogs that we're seeing at the minute, it's just, it's brilliant to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Twiggy would hold her own still because she was incredible. Mm-hmm. She was so fast.
She would.
Yeah.
I remember watching some videos of because I obviously used to, well, you when you get into agility, you then get into the wormhole of watching old finals and stuff like that. And you just see dogs like that and you think, oh my God.
She gave me the fear. I have always been competitive in sports, but I've never suffered fear like I did when I ran her. I mean, I've overcome it now, which is why, you know, I would definitely get another one. But I was so scared. And when I started, because I was grade 1. And although she came out technically grade 3 because Diamond won out.
Yeah.
I mean, it was only a couple of months earlier and I didn't know anything. I mean, and I remember people come, you know, judges going, oh, what a dog, don't mess it up. And they can pile on this pressure on you. God. And you're like, you just feel it. You're like, oh, I know. But the thing is with Dime, when he ran, there was only, you could not control his speed. You just had to show him the course. There was no stopping him, no slowing him. But Twiggy would slow down if you wanted her to. And that's a double-edged sword because you knew she was so fast, but your mind couldn't cope with it. So you wanted to slow it down. And of course that messes it up anyway, doesn't it? And so she's definitely one of my favorite. And I just remember getting over my fear one day, just telling myself, well, you're ruining it anyway. and you know, and then the other thing I would say to myself is I would look at it and go, how can I make you faster? Because I think that turns the problem on its head. I was scared of her speed because I didn't feel like I can cope with it. But if you say to yourself, how can you make her faster? Mm-hmm. You're sort of saying subconsciously, you're fast enough. You need more. So I can cope with it. Does that make sense?
Oh, God, yeah. Do you know what? I can quite relate to that, actually, with my young dog. She's not a full Cocker Spaniel. She's half and half poodle. But very similar to run, that fear of like, oh, God, I don't know if I can manage that. And then, as you say, that when I needed to slow down, she would. But that's a very good point.
I love that edge of control feeling they have now, but I didn't at the time. But I did get over it. She helped me get over it. But going back to the lines, there's a couple of lines I really should mention. I mean, Malladale, very athletic, very strong. And I think they're showing up quite a lot in the agility spaniels now, and they just look stunning to look at. And there's a couple of dogs that if I see on the pedigree, I already know they're going to move well. I just know. Sometimes I can look at them and tell that they've got that in the background. And Walkley Reaver and Darndale Dealer are two dogs that I just love when I see in the pedigree.
Oh, God, yeah. I love the Walkley lines as well. They're really nice dogs there. And I quite like one I didn't come across until I was introduced to it through my breeder for my spaniel is the, I don't know if you've heard of the Tarn Craglines, but they've got some, yeah, again, quite, you know, quite working, like, not maybe not stocky, they're nicely built, but they're, yeah, heavier than, you know, some of, yeah, the spaniels we could see in agility rings sometimes, but they come out really nice as well from what I've seen and what I've experienced.
Yeah, and what I like about spaniels is I mean, you know, going back to one of the questions you're saying about,
yes,
warning about, you know, the one, what, oh, would, yeah, you say, yeah, to people is the biggest thing that I come across is people wanting certain height for spaniels.
Yes, yes.
And it baffles me. And I know I'm a hypocrite because the last current dogs were small, but genuinely I like running all heights.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I kept Crash from my litter was because I wanted a medium height because I got two small girls. And so I like running all height. And I don't understand why everybody's so fixated on small, because when you look abroad, it doesn't matter if they're small or medium, they're so competitive. They're,
oh God,
so,
yeah,
competitive. So to me, I'm like, just relax and just, you know.
And I think, like, sorry, you go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. I was just going to say that they're quite, you can't predict, there's no way of looking at pedigree and say that dog will be. You can only hedge bets. They generally, you know, they're genuinely borderline, if I'm honest.
Oh God, yeah. And I think, yeah, I say it's such a good point, because if you're going into it for height, I sometimes think you're going into it for the wrong reason.
100%. Yeah.
Like, if yeah, I mean, as we said, I mean, you do get, you know, quite a variety in sizes with working Cocker Spaniels. That's, you know, it's just one of those kind of unpredictable things sometimes. But I definitely think kind of having that mindset of, I only want a small, you just,
yeah,
I think you're kind of setting yourself up for potentially a disappointment that, you know, some, you can't guarantee it. As you say, I mean, I've known dogs come out of two small parents and be top end medium, so yeah, it's like you just can't guarantee just anything.
and it baffles me, because look at James Adams, he's doing amazing.
Yeah,
it's, you know, it's, and when Di was around, he achieved everything that the collies, you know, at the time,
yeah,
could achieve. I mean, it's just, yeah, and it's your journey at the end of the day, and there's only room for one world champion, so I think you just got to enjoy your journey, if that makes sense, rather than, you know, only thinking the small's the easier way. It certainly isn't easy for me anyway. I think smalls are very competitive. And, you know.
Oh, God, yeah. And I also, because, again, my youngest one, she just happened to end up small. She's my first small out of a run of medium dogs. And honestly, I find her so much harder to run because I have no airtime whatsoever.
Yes.
She makes me run. She's faster than my other dogs, but also makes me have to do more work. So
yeah,
I quite like my mediums for that.
Yeah. I just love running all heights. I mean, I'm not going to be hypocritical and say, I must admit, I mean, when I look for Zippy, I was looking for a small, but that's only because I know it's harder. If she went medium, it's fine. It honestly is fine. I just love running all heights. So I love a small, a medium, and a large. I mean, I'm not going to run four dogs. I know we got intermediate. I think I'll stick with a small, medium, and an intermediate or large now. But yeah, I just love that challenge, and having a breed that you can live with as well is that's what I really want.
That is really important. And I think, like I say, with the breeder side of it, speaking to breeders about actually what's this dog like to live with, and also people who own them, because, you know, I mean, we both live spaniels, so when you know them, they're easier. But I think if you've never had one before, it's a bit of a shock to the system, I must admit.
It is. I remember when Dime and Twiggy, because don't forget they're only a few months apart, was, I think, 6 and 9 months, I think they were. And I remember sitting on my sofa with my head in my hands going, what have I done? Because they were just running riot. I didn't understand how to work their brains then. I just did agility and walking, and that's it. And agility was like, you know, I used to go once a week and that sort of thing. So I didn't really use their brain that much.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't meeting their needs, and I didn't know that. And actually, when you say 6 to 8, they weren't even doing agility at that time. So I just had two puppies running around the house. So I just remember it, you know, it's just hard work. And yeah, and I think if you hadn't faced that, you don't know that. And also, if you love the breed or love the personality, you don't care what problems come up.
Because, oh God, no.
You've already got that bond, you'll work through it. But if you don't, I think you can resent it a little bit, because you've sort of, but they're your tool, that's why they're not working. Does that make sense? And I don't like that way of living.
No, I 100% agree, because, well, for context with my Spaniel, I did three years of research before I got him. I got him when I was 19, but I'd been debating between Spaniels and Collies for a long time, but always begged for one, but it wasn't until I was older that it was, when it was more my responsibility that I was allowed one. But yeah, I just think you've got to really enjoy the breed and actually be around them, because I think, you know, having a small glimpse of what they're like isn't maybe sometimes predictable of them all the time.
But that's also quite hard because they're so different, aren't they?
Yeah.
Some of them are so calm and chilled, and some of them are just nutty and crazy.
Well, I was quite lucky because I worked in a doggy daycare from 16 to 19, so I got to experience all sorts of dogs in there. But one of our most popular breeds was working cockers, because obviously people who work and had got one and thought, I can't leave this dog at home all day, so they'd come to a daycare. I'm not saying I agree with daycares anymore, because and not that I agreed them at the time, but it was just a good experience for me. But the dogs that, I mean, I was able to live with them, spend, you know, a whole day with different breeds and actually get to know them. And I think if people can have like an experience where you can maybe look after a friend's one or just spend a whole day with one, gives a much grander picture of what to expect. And also maybe that line wasn't suitable for you, but maybe a different one would.
It definitely goes a lot about saying, like, meet the litter, meet the mums and dads if you can, meet the brothers and sister, talk to people who've had pups from those breeders before, you know, because people who have their dogs are quite passionate. They don't I don't see many hide, you know, good or bad experiences. They're honest if you talk to them. Breeders maybe not so, because, you know, they love their lines, don't they, and they love their dogs, and they only see like the best out of them. But you tend to see honesty from owners. They won't, because they've got they're not going to give you their dog, are they? So there's nothing to hide, is there?
Yeah, 100%. And I'm always very open and honest of if anyone ever asks me questions about mine, kind of what the pros and cons are and what kind of things I've had to work through with them. Obviously, each being an individual. But I think that's a really good point as well, speaking to actually the owners. And also maybe touching on it as well, because obviously there's been a huge surge on social media just recently about a particular breeder. But just doing your background research as well, looking on maybe MyKC and looking actually how many puppies are they having a year under that affix, and just really looking into and trying to get down to it.
It is hard to find, because the Kennel Club have changed their website. It used to be really easy to look up a kennel name, and now it's impossible. It is really hard. But I find I've been looking for a pup for quite some time. So I've been using the health test finder. So if you can find at least one name there, you can quite often use it to look at the other dogs that they own through parents and siblings and what they've produced, and then you go through that, and it's amazing what you can find out through that. Because for me, my biggest bugbear is back-to-back litters. That's the big warning sign for me. Why do you need to like breed 6 to 8 months, 9 months straight after the litter? I mean, don't forget the pups are brewing for 9 weeks, so no sooner have they born, you know, you're waiting. It doesn't that's not nice. I don't understand why you can't wait. And that you will see that, because if you see the litter, you'll see how many litters they've had. You only have to look at the days. Yes.
And I think as well, looking at how many litters a mum is having as well, you know, if they're pushing four, you start to think, if they're doing that regularly with all of their mothers as well, is this a lot? And I think as well, another great, I don't know if you've mentioned it, but the Cocker Spaniel database as well. That's fantastic for looking as well for different kind of lines and looking at the dog. And and I like that it includes pictures as well, some of them.
Yes, it does. I mean, someone's put mine up. I didn't upload some of my dogs. So it's really good. But the biggest thing I find actually is, because you're in agility, everyone's your friend. It's a great community, isn't it? And I have bred a few litters, and I'm really not knocking the owners, honestly, because I've got the information if they want. But it's amazing when I have inquiries and things, how many, they just take whatever I say, they just take it as truth. And I think, I don't, you know, if in reality you've got this dog for hopefully a long time, like 10 to 15 years, 18 years, 20 years, some of them. Maybe not Spaniels, but, you know, Jack Russells and things. But yeah, you have them for a long time. It's worth doing the research. And it just baffles me that just because I've said they've got these tests, you're not, you know, nobody asked to see. Like when I give a puppy, I always give them all the copies of, of the certificates and things like that. But, you know, it's worth like actually asking to see them or asking for the numbers of them or asking them how many dogs they own. How many dogs do they breed from? That's the number one, actually, because I don't mind if people ask me that. I haven't got anything to hide. Come and see me. I mean, quite often some people have asked to come and see my dogs and how they are, which is great because it shows me that they care not about my dogs, but they care like how their puppy's going to be. Does that make sense? Because they care about what
how they'll turn out.
It's a good indicator, isn't it?
Oh god, yeah. And I think as well with that, actually when a breeder wants to know more about you as well, I think that's a huge thing. So not just kind of offering you a puppy right off the bat, more if you know, I've kind of been on a few lists over the years with different dogs, and I really like when a breeder sends me a questionnaire and asks me I mean, I've been asked all sorts, and I don't mind as a potential puppy buyer, but I think it's so important that a breeder actually wants to know you and know where the dog's going.
Definitely. And also, I mean, come and see the I think it's harder for you know, when you're abroad trying to buy a puppy, but we are a community. And I think it's, if you really want that pup from abroad, either go there and find out for yourself before you put your money down, or ask a friend to go and do it for you, if that makes sense. Yeah. Don't take word for it, because it's rubbish. You know, you don't know. You just don't, you know, I could have my puppies in a dungeon for all you know, until you come and see me. And do you know what? It is obvious when you come and see it. So I remember going to see Ninja Zippy's litter, and I brought a load of toys with me, and she had the puppies there, and it was obvious this is their home and everything. They were so at home there. They were happy. They were just, you know, everywhere. I mean, she was sending me videos anyway each day, but I brought a bag of toys because I was a bit naive then, and I just went, oh, let's see how they are with them. And I just emptied it out on the floor. What an idiot. And they all ran away.
They all came
out eventually, but they all ran away. And I was like, well, of course they would. It's all new. I've just thrown a load of new stuff in. So that to me is a warning sign. Like, it goes the other way. If the puppies aren't used to being in that environment, they will not act like confident and happy.
Yeah.
It's no excuses saying, oh, they're tired, they're this. Well, if they're tired and they're this, wait. Because if they're tired, they'll, you know, sometimes you do catch them, they're tired, but they will wake up, and then you'll see their true personalities. They're puppies. Everything's in tiny micro moments, aren't they?
Yes. Oh, God, yeah. 100%. And I just thought of another thing as well that I was going to say. What was it? Oh, it's one of those where it'll come back to me halfway through and I'll be like, oh, I wish I'd said that.
Well, the biggest thing for me is if a breeder's selling themselves to me, telling me they've got the greatest puppy. I remember getting a message years ago about, I've got the perfect puppy for you. This is just made for you. I'm helping you out in all this sort of thing. That's like warning signs, really, especially if they're not people that you go go training with every single week, or going out socially, isn't it? If it's just somebody you compete with very, you know, occasionally at a show, that's not a true friend. So therefore, why have they got this perfect, how do they know what the perfect puppy is for me? They don't know me that well. They just know who I am in agility. They don't know me. So that to me speaks red alarms, doesn't it? And also, if you can't see the puppies, I'm sorry, no. And photos, videos, don't do it. It's not good enough. It's definitely not good. I mean, yes, they help. It's great. And you shouldn't go along it with true suspicion. But it is important that you are happy about where your puppy comes from, happy how it's raised. Because it's not just about the puppy. It's about the mother and the dad that you leave behind.
Exactly. Yeah, 100%. Because you do see it a lot where, I mean, I've visited a few litters in my time, and in terms of, not even just for me, for maybe relatives, and you know, it's sometimes people think if it's not the right thing that they're protecting the puppy by taking
it, but actually take it out of the environment, they're saving it. No, you've just condemned another puppy to face it,
and the mother parents.
Another year
100%. And it's quite sad, but I think definitely researching as much as you can get information wise, and I couldn't agree more about not being able to see the puppies being a huge red flag, because I've had that before, and straight away I was like, nothing else for that person.
puppy farming and badly bred puppies can stop right now if every buyer follows similar protocols.
Yes.
It just becomes too hard. And if anything's too hard, it doesn't happen. So I don't understand. Like, I understand that we, you know, that people want to breed and all that lot, and they want big kennels. And I don't, you know, I struggle with it, but I don't really have a big problem with it as long as the dogs that stay there are clean. But also they have mental stimulation. So they're doing something, not just festering in a clean kennel, churning out puppies. They're doing something. They're getting walked and worked and that sort of thing. That's quite important to me. But it's so, you know, if people made it harder and made it like, you know, everybody did the same thing, then the breeders, it just wouldn't be worth their while because it would cost too much to maintain what they need to do to sell the puppies. So it really, it is the power is with the people, not with the breeder. That's why breeders take shortcuts the way they do. You know, I'm not naming names. I'm really not. It could be anybody. I'll meet in the motorway because it will save you the journey. I know you've got a long journey, so I'll bring the puppy to you. It's no problem to me. I mean, hello. You've got it 15 years. Go drive up to Scotland if you live in Cornwall. It's worth it.
100%. I mean, I've done Wales, I've done all sorts to go get my puppies, but I couldn't agree more. I think that, again, like you say, with service stations and stuff, huge red flag. Unless you've had a friend actually visit and see them in person and stuff, it's just straight away a red flag.
Yeah, again, I could be hypocritical. I have delivered a puppy, but the owners have been in my house.
Yes.
Seen my puppies before. I just happened to be in the area the day that, you know, the week that it was ready. So, but they've already been to my, I always make every person that's ever bought one of my puppies I've had in the house. They've seen them whilst the puppies are there, not before, whilst the puppies are here. I wouldn't have it any other way, including people that come from abroad.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Like you say, and from a breeder's perspective as well, you want them to come see you because if people aren't wanting to visit, you want to know where your puppy's going and that they're invested. So 100%. And I think there's a huge law in, isn't there? Lucy's Law, am I speaking right? So I'll try and put a link on this podcast anyways if anyone wants to look at that about looking out for puppy farms, because sometimes they are very well hidden and people can be duped, and puppy farmers are getting more and more intelligent.
They hire out houses now, so it looks all set up, and it's incredible what goes on now. But the biggest thing in agility that saddens me is I think some people are willing to cut corners for perceived success.
Yes,
and that's what worries me.
Yeah,
because it's not a done deal. It, you know, how many puppies were bred to for those few that made it to the top?
100%. You can't guarantee anything, but when there's thousands of puppies, of course there's going to be one or two in there that are going to make something a success, but it's just not worth it for those hundreds of puppies that have had that lifestyle of not had a life really. So
and then also I've got to say is also I think it's important that all of us play a role, like all of us. So if you know, if you've done your research and you suspect that the puppies aren't raised or the parents aren't in the lifestyle that they should be and things aren't right, but you think that they're successful, you can get your dog now or something like that, or it's something that you want. We all have a responsibility of how that looks around us, because some people, you know, your friends look at you, look up to you as well, don't they? Take advice. And if you do in the sport, people look at you and go, well, look what they've got and look what they've done, where they've got it. So, so we all bear that responsibility as well. And it saddens me that people are willing to sell their morals really for this, even though, you know, other people look at you as well and think, well, they're doing it, so I can do it. And as I said, power's in the people. If we all stick to our guns and insist on it, even if you want it from those breeders, but you insist on that way and you won't have it any other way, then maybe things will change.
And I also think as well, it's very, because I mean, we're very fortunate in the UK that spaniels, there are a lot of them, and a lot of people breeding them, and a lot better than others. But also, like you say, with them being so closely related, if you've got a bad feeling about a particular breeder but you know that line's okay, you can get can find a puppy so similar and from
almost just look at the grandparents.
Lines. Yeah, yeah, 100%.
Because they've all come from the grandparents. Yeah. The other thing I will say though is there's a couple of and I'm not going to name names, you really need to do your research, but yes, just watch social media. Just because it looks like the puppies are in playful living rooms and doing all this, it doesn't take much to look at, you know, as I said, I use my health test finder. It doesn't take much to find out that those breeders that don't, that may not be breeding as many litters. Well, a puppy, you know, when you're looking at ethics, when did it start? When did the bad ethics start? It usually starts from good breeding, and then money's made, and then greed comes in possibly, and then the boundaries break, and then more litters happen. You can't manage it so well, so it's not as clean. You have too many dogs around. Do you see what I mean? This is where it spirals.
It just spirals, yeah.
100%. Yeah, and where does it start? And so for me, the warning signs are always heavy marketing, social media showing amazing living rooms or house environments, playful, all this sort of thing. But actually, once you look at them, there's dogs that they have in there that have had back-to-back litters, three or four litters, 6 months, 8 months, 6 months. That's a warning sign to me. Move away.
Oh, gotcha. 100%.
So, yeah, because that's the start. Or if they're suddenly buying in a load of dogs.
Why
do you suddenly need to buy them? And why are you breeding from them like literally weeks or a month, you know, after getting them? Why? You haven't had enough time to see what their temperament's like, to see if it's right to breed from them. So that tells me that your motivation is money only. Mm. And that's another warning sign. So, you know, just do your research, and then I think it's relatively easy then to stay on the right track. I don't buy all this, oh, I was taken in.
Oh, yeah. I think all of us have such, I mean, like I say, it's a huge responsibility, because you're taking in a dog that's going to be the next 10, 15 years of your life. And also, as you say as well, if that dog's going to do well, people are going to look at it. And do you want to be tied to that person and that breeder for the remainder of that dog's life? It's there's a lot to it, especially in agility. 100%.
Yeah, it matters. It really matters. And it helps everybody, I think, if we all stick together and look for good lines, good dogs, healthy dogs, you know, because we've got, I mean, agility is not saving lives. Mm. There's no excuses, really, if I'm honest, to not have, well, you know, nice dogs that are brought up well. We owe it to them.
Oh, God, yeah, 100%. Mm. And if, you know, like I say, if you want a dog that's going to enjoy a career in agility, health and the way where they're raised and all the kind of aspects that come with it are so important for that. So amazing. Yeah. I think we could talk, we could do a whole podcast just on that. That be a whole one of its own. But I've got lots of questions for us to still go through. So next question, which is a really good one. What are the most common mistakes you see people make with their Spaniels, and how would you advise they improve this?
So the one of the, I won't say the biggest, but one of the, there's several things I see quite often, and quite often it's grabbing at them. So that's the number one I see, because Spaniels can be quite impulsive, quite fast, and they're very into their movement anyway.
Yeah.
And everybody's trying to contain them because they're worried that they're going to run off or jump up or steal something. I don't know. So there's a lot of lunging and grabbing, and that can result actually in the behavior getting worse. Usually it always involves the dog running off, always. It ruins your recall faster than anything, and it ruins any kind of toy or play retrieve, and also a relationship, because the dogs start ducking and diving because they're like, you're going to come for me in a minute, I'm about to be put away in a minute, you're going to take something off me in a minute. So for me, to counteract that, I would do lots of retrieve games and lots of recall games. And you know, and a little trick I do actually is, if your dog's not retrieving a toy and you really want them to, I actually put the toy, so I know flexi leads are banned and everyone should use them. I think they're a great training tool for this. So I like to play my retrieve games in a house or in a contained area like a garden, and then slowly bring it out. But some people don't generally go to, like, you know, sometimes clubs and fields, and then they feel like, now what do I do? So they feel stuck. Well, in those scenarios, put the toy on a flexi lead.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, so, you know, or the dog, but generally I put it on the toy, because you know, then it can only go so far and you can work on it a little bit. So that's something I would use for that. Or the other thing is, people worry about Spaniel sniffing a lot. Actually, with the pups, they don't want to sniff, they're very worried, you know. Any dog, it's natural for them to sniff.
Okay,
Spaniels were bred to use their noses more so than, say, other breeds. But, you know, let them be dogs. My thing would be, work on the distractions and let them have sniffing times. I won't tell them to go sniff. I mean, somebody said teach them a word to go sniff, and I find that a bit bizarre because I like eating donuts. But when I've done my tax return, you don't go, now eat a donut. I'm just going to do it anyway in my spare time. And it's the same for a spaniel.
Yeah.
So what I would say is engage with the dog and play lots of distraction games, lots of play games and little small increment time. And then when they finish playing the game or the training part, I say, you know, off you go or whatever, and let them be a spaniel, let them be a sniff. And if you don't want them wandering off and charging about and ruining everybody else's session, well, you can do that with them on a lead, just loose lead, you know, and so that you're not worried about that. The other thing is they worry about distractions, don't they? So I find that quite a lot, distraction training.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the biggest mistake is, well, it's not the biggest mistake. That's not right. It's just people worry about the distractions, so they try and bribe their dogs the whole time. So the dog's constantly getting food for just nothing, just sitting there because they're so worried about the dog going out and doing stuff. And so for me, I would counteract that really and play lots of sort of distraction games. So anything that involves movement is really good for spaniels because they love it. So I call like shadow handling's my favorite game. So if people come to my training days and it's puppies, I always put that in on one of the sessions. It's very important. Everybody hates it. I hate it too, but it's one of the most important games you can play with your dog. It's basically pretending there's an agility equipment running around a field sort of thing with agility equipment, but there's no equipment there. It's just an empty field. It's just you and the dog. It's like circle work. I think it used to be a game years ago. But basically, it's using your movement to rotate so the dogs learn to follow you, value for you. And with that, they learn to ignore all the surroundings around them. And with that, they learn to avoid all the distractions around them. And they learn to follow your arm. And they learn to not jump up at the toy until you say that they can have it. So it's the biggest, fastest game at working around distractions there are. And also I like to take my dogs playing and trick training as many different places as possible. And I start young. So I don't start young doing agility training, but I do play games and toy play and trick games. All these are distraction games in tiny little moments, and I play them all the time. And if I can't, then I'll create my own distraction. So it's in my living room and I can create my own distraction. I'll bang on something on the side or whilst I'm playing, or you know, have another dog in the room. It's easy to create, but as long as you work in the distraction slowly so you don't overwhelm them, there's no point if your dog's easily distracted trying to play tug with them in the middle of a football field where the game's going on. I get that. Start slowly and quietly and build it up. And I think that would help all those things, to be honest. And I think that's all of them, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh wow. I mean, I'm already thinking, God, I need to go out and do some shadow handling with my dog.
Shadow handling is the number one game. I don't care what anyone says, it's my number one game. And when I get a puppy, it starts from 8 weeks. The moment I've got them onto a toy, I'm doing it. And you start off slowly, obviously, puppies are tiny.
Yeah.
But it's literally, and when you start to compete, it's my warm up.
Oh, I see.
So it's sort of, it's hard to describe it because it's very hard to put it in words. But basically, it's using your momentum to create fun and following, and they get used to your arm movements. But it just helps so much.
Oh, amazing. No, that's very helpful. And I think that those are some fantastic solutions there. I really liked the use of the flexor lead with a toy, actually. I think that was quite a unusual use for it. And I think those are very helpful. Thank you for that.
Great.
Next question, which is sort of similar, actually, in troubleshooting. But
yeah,
what do you find motivates spaniels most? And I know they're all individual, but
how
would you go about finding that right reward for a spaniel?
If I'm honest, so when I get a spaniel home, at the end of the day, the most rewarding thing for them, contrary to what everybody thinks, is playing with another dog, usually.
Yes.
That's what they want to do more than anything. And we're not dogs, we're humans. So everything we do is new to them and we have to respect that. Mm-hmm. It's going to be hard, it's going to take time, but it's worth it. So not many spaniels come home playing. Sometimes they do, but not a lot of them do. So the first thing I will do is get my dogs into as many different types of play as I can. So tug, ball retrieve. It's amazing what you can do. Following you, running around, chasing. I do use treats. I know. Yeah, I do use treats, but I use them separately, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
Because I do know that's a big food motivator, but it is a big food motivator. It's a big motivator, quite simply, because everybody eats. Dogs eat.
Yeah.
So it's a natural motivator. But the toy play you have to build. It's not something that's a given for everybody. And every dog's different. The one thing I will say to people, and I do believe this, is I don't care how hard it is, try not to put too much pressure on yourself. I think people try to go for the tug too early.
Yeah.
So, and really, chasing is the start. I just want my dogs to chase first. I'm not expecting an 8-week-old puppy to grab and tug it.
Yeah.
Or if you've got a rescue and you come in and go, well, I've thrown this thing at them and they're not tugging. Chase is first. Try not to be confrontational by facing your dog on. I always turn to the side and I'll drag whatever it is that they can have. And you want to make it so that they feel like they can win it, but don't make it too easy. Like the amount of times I've seen people shake a toy in a dog's face. Well, I'd hate to bring it up to people, but basically tug is chasing something, a prey,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what they're doing.
100%.
Yeah. And no animal in the wild goes, kill me, I'm here. They just don't. They always run away. So that's what you're mimicking, really, is that chase. And that's the bit. And just make it fun and keep the sessions super short. So that's, and I basically say with puppies, I'm not saying this very well, but basically with puppies, I will try everything, everything constantly up to about probably 8 to 10 months. I say 10 months. Mm-hmm. 10 months, you get the idea of what they really love, what really work. I still work on everything, but 10 months, they tell me, I find tugging too confrontational. I'm doing it because you're saying it. And yeah. I love the ball play. And I really love food, or I really love latex toys, but I really hate rope toys. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And and the lovely thing about having a dog, it's not just puppies, is it? It's having any dog, because a lot of them can come from rescue. It's having that journey and developing that play in games and finding out what they love and what they don't. And I've discovered, and thinking outside the box, don't think my dog must do this. Zippy absolutely went crazy if I ripped grass. I mean, she'd be savage. She'd attack me with it. She's so crazy. And Twiggy used to love water. And I remember having, I used to take a paddling pool and hiding it behind the secretary's tent. So when we finished our run, I would race through the agility show for this paddling pool for Twiggy to enjoy, because that was the bestest thing in the world for her.
Oh, bless her. Like I said, that very, very outside the box. I mean, we had last week, last episode with Craig, there was talk of using, I think it was horse manure or something for hounds and stuff. So, like I say, there's nothing that's untouchable. I mean, that respect, it could be. But
it is very important when they're young to keep trying, because at the end of the day, spaniels are very clever.
Yes.
And when animals are clever, they can be manipulative. And I don't mean this in a nasty, negative way. I'm really not. It's the same as us. If we think we can get something, we'll go for it. But it doesn't mean that we don't like the other thing. So for me, I know toy and treat swap's a big thing for some trainers. I personally have struggled with that with some spaniels.
Mm-hmm.
So I will try, when they first come home and they're into the toy, I will do the toy treat swap and I'll try. Mm. But quite often I tend to park it. So what I will do is, if they're really food motivated, then I will play all the toy training games that I'd like to play first.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no food, there's no sign of it. And then later I will do the food training things. And then later in life, you find that you can do it anyway. You can toy and treat swap. But that's how I do when they develop, and vice versa. So if they're really into their toy. So Zippy, if she saw her toy, she didn't want food. So I would do the food games first, and then so food games generally are thinking games, so trick training, that sort of thing. So when you're doing agility equipment, usually it's like the contact behavior, isn't it? Quite often food's used for that, and wing wraps when it's skill work, and then when it's fast work, you tend to use toy, I find. So with those sort of dogs, I would always use the thing that they love the most last, or separate, just separate basically. And then later I will bring it in. I find that they are fine doing toy and treat swaps later in life when they're like a year into their training. But when they're very young, it can be a real battle, and some people can feel quite demoralised with it. And if you just park it, you can address it when they're older.
Oh, God, yeah. And I guess a good way to sort of look at it from a human's perspective, if you had a toddler in front of you and you said, well, actually, I'm going to feed you now, but you can't have the iPad. And it's similar, isn't it? You take in something that's very rewarding to them. But in that moment, that's what they won't prefer more.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
why fight it? Like, it's your journey. Yeah. Like, who are you, you know, who's going to go, oh, well done, you've managed to do your toy treat swap, but it's taking you 4 hours and you're exhausted. Like, it, for me, I'm looking at the long-term journey, and I'm hoping to have, like, in 5 years' time, the best I can get out of my dog in agility and the best I can get out of my dog at home to live with and all that lot. It's a five-year journey. It could be, you know, quite often you meet those goals earlier, but, you know, overall, they generally say in the agility anyway, dogs peak about that time, don't they?
Yeah. I'm very much holding on to that because my last dog did, and my spaniel's about four and a half at the minute. So I'm holding on to that year five peak, hopefully.
Yeah. So it's a journey, isn't it? So why does it matter if they can't? You know, I just think it's your journey. Enjoy it. It's really important. But I really struggle with the treats. I think people, not all, I'm not, you know, a lot of people go to those treats too early. Mm-hmm. And I just think, keep trying.
Yeah.
It's worth it. Just keep trying. Don't think, because, and the reason I say it's because I truly believe that motivation and drive comes from play. And it's very hard to play. It's not impossible, but it's very hard to play with treats because they're eating and they have to be still to eat. So it's quite hard. So I'm not saying don't use treats. If you find when they're older, that's all they want, then there are some cracking toys. In fact, I designed one that, so I'm sponsored by Paws Trading, and I asked them, because they have those, you know, those clam things you can throw.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. I said they were like shuttlecocks. They don't really go anywhere, and it was really frustrating. Can they add a weight to it of some kind so I can throw it like a real toy, but the dogs can have that reward that they love, the food reward? Mm-hmm. And they did a fantastic job. They did better than my imagination, and they look amazing. And it enables those dogs that will only like food to have the chase that you would have from a normal toy, but then they get the food at the end.
Yeah.
So it's a way of mixing the two together.
And there is, like I say, Paws Trader do a lot. I mean, I've got quite a few of their products, and they do a lot of toys that are very food and play sort of related. So you can have that, you know.
You can.
You can. I wanted to keep going with it.
I can. I just believe that, why don't you want all the tools in your box? That's all. Mm. So when they're young, or when you've just got them home, try everything and keep trying. But keep the sessions short. Like, the biggest mistake, actually, you said about mistakes earlier. One of the biggest mistakes, I think, is quite often, let's be honest, agility used to be mainly collies.
Yes. Yep.
And I found that I'm not saying all, you always get your anomalies, but majority of people, collies like repetition and they can train for a long time.
Yes.
Well, spaniels, that tends to be not the case. They do not like repetition, and generally, and their attention span is tiny compared to a collie. So the biggest advice I say to people is, who's had collies and it's their first spaniel, is train them like a collie, but a fraction of the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like a fraction. And, you know, they'll learn fast. They won't be behind, and they'll enjoy it and they love it.
Perfect. No, that is that was fantastic answer to those questions. Thank you. Next question's a really good one as well, actually, and this one was so popular. I mean, I've had to condense quite a few into one, actually, because it was all about surrounding sensitivity in spaniels. How do you manage this, and what advice would you give to someone struggling with their dog in competition, for example, but they train at home no problem? So that's kind of a bit of an example there, but generally in how you would manage sensitivity.
So this is hard for me. It's because it's so complex. Because every case will be totally different to another, if I'm honest. And that's why I think behaviors play a great part in this, because they see the individual. But generally speaking, the way to fix distraction, not distraction, the sensitivity, is the same way that you deal with reactive dogs or dogs that have short attention spans, attention seeking dogs. It's really is that engaging the distractions around them and letting them helping them work and live through life regardless of what's around them. And so with sensitive dogs, generally speaking, we tend to, not all of us, but some people tend to shy away because they don't want to see their dog worried, and they they take them away from situations and they manage them. And I must be honest, fears always grow. I really believe that, because mm-hmm. I've got a really big spider fear, or had.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, well, there you go. So you'll know. So when you're young, your spider fear wouldn't have been as big as it probably is as an mm-hmm. adult. And that's because you've lived your life and you have got coping mechanisms and manipulating the surroundings to stop you ever encountering a spider.
Yes.
And if you see one, you know how to, you know, for how to people to deal with it, and you've manipulated that situation. And so for me, it got to a point where I wouldn't travel to certain countries. I wouldn't even live in a house that had a ground floor or a garden. You know, it's just crazy. It took over my life because my fears grew. And one day I was sick of it, because I lived in a house and I had to pay a taxi driver £10 to kill this spider, because it was 10 o'clock at night and I couldn't make my neighbor do it.
Oh my God.
Exactly. It's ridiculous. And I felt, this is silly. It's controlling my life. So I had to face my fears. And the only way you're going to face your fears is meeting your fears. And I'm not talking about flooding. So please, if your dog's scared of noise, don't just take it to a rock concert. I'm not talking about that. But I do believe you have to address it, and you have to address it patiently and patiently, and take your time, but keep moving forward.
Yeah,
don't justify it and go, this is fine, this is how we're going to be, because you'll never get to where you can be, and you can overcome all these fears. So I would start by taking them out more and more places, but start gently. So if they're noise sensitive, and if people often wonder what it is. So for me, the biggest sign for a dog that's not sure about something is actually the ears go back first.
Yeah.
And that's quite a subtle sign. I think people pick up on that. And I definitely didn't pick up on that before. Mm-hmm. These are things that really helped me when I saw. So Rob Elaine is the person that really helped me help with Zippy when she shut down at Crufts. I had no clue what was going on, because Zippy to me was confident all her life. There was no sign of it until that day that I was there. And mm-hmm. obviously when it happened, I didn't know what to do. And he came and he said, oh, she's noise reactive, sensitive. He didn't say reactive, sensitive. And he basically was talking about the second fear period. And did I do all these things that second fear period, I think, happens when the puppies are about 8 to 14 months. There's a time scale in there, isn't there? And it happens to all creatures. Like, humans go through it too. You're a very confident, you're a scared baby, a confident toddler, and you're back to being an anxious teenager, and then you're confident as a young adult. So it happens to everybody, every creature. And you just have to go through the same socializing that you did with the puppy and keep maintaining it. Like, we don't do it, do we? We take our dogs everywhere when we have them, and then we tick the boxes, and then we don't do it anymore.
Like, yeah.
We don't go to those pubs as often, or garden centres like everybody loves doing with their puppies. And actually, you should do it all the time, because the more times you do it, the more likely they'll come up against random noises and things that are new to them. The one thing I will say with sensitivity and agility is I think people focus on only the agility. So they think, well, my dog's scared of this, so I can only deal with it in agility. And that's not true. Generally speaking, if your dog can deal with any random, because you're not going to be able to fix every sound they'll ever meet, because that's impossible. But if you help them get through random things that happen, then they will soon learn it doesn't matter, because I'm winning with you. Whatever happens, we're fine.
Yeah, and do you know what? I really like how you picked up on there, the second fear period and kind of continuing it and everything. And also, I couldn't not relate more about the spider part as well.
I had to face my fears, and I didn't like doing it, by the way. Yeah. And I didn't do it by jumping in a room full of spiders, but I did do it by going through hypnosis and seeing spiders and holding spiders. It was horrible, but I did. It wasn't pleasant. But it did have to be done, and I'm grateful for it. And this is a hard thing at the moment, because I think we're in a what's going on at the moment is we mustn't ever let our dogs go through any kind of negativity.
Yeah.
And this is a hard one to talk about, because it's kind of hard to put across what I'm trying to say.
Yes.
But,
yeah.
I think it's right to go through a little bit of discomfort if it's temporary, if it means lifelong confidence.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, I, from a human perspective, I can relate to that as well, actually, because, for example, in my previous role, we worked in an office, and we worked right near a nature kind of walk, and the amount of house spiders in that place was ridiculous. Yeah. And any corner I looked in, they were there. So yeah. I kind of just had to kind of be discomfort for a while, but actually after a couple of weeks, it became the norm. And then you sort of see one, but you don't have that initial like scream reaction. I mean, I used to scream when I saw them. Whereas now it's much sort of, I can look at them and feel, okay, I don't feel great around it, but I can manage that it's in the area. And I think
you feel empowered then, don't you? Because it hasn't controlled you. And,
100%.
And but I will say it's about doing it slowly and gently, but keep moving forward.
Yeah.
So that's the most important thing. And try the other thing that I find, and this is so hard to put into words, and I'm trying to do it the right way, because I was guilty of it too, is when you know your dog's worried, you worry, and that does pass on to the dog. It just does.
Yes. Oh, God.
And so quite often the best advice I say to people is, I know you care about the dog, and I know you worry about if it's worried, and what we tend to do by doing that is we stare at the dog.
Yeah.
And that's what we do, and it's only because you care.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, when you do that and you look down at your dog, it's just like when you're at school and that teacher is staring at you from above. It's a lot of pressure, and it can often make the dog feel worse. And I know it's not intentional, obviously. You care. I did it. But actually what can happen is the dog's going, I'm really not sure of this environment. What should I do about it? And they look up to you for guidance, and you're looking at them, and they're looking, thinking, oh no, the person that's with me also isn't happy with this environment.
Mm.
Now what do we do?
Yeah.
And instead, if you just, I know this is hard, but I look peripherally at my dog to see how they are, but I want to give them the impression that I'm confident and I'm calm and I'm relaxed. So I will walk my shoulders high and I'll look up, just like, you know, if you think about a waiting room or an interview room, everybody looks like they're twitching their fingers and they're looking a bit worried, aren't they? Compared to a pub setting when everyone's chilled, relaxed.
Yeah.
You kind of got to give that impression for the dog. So I think the best advice is just, I always say, fast heel work. So it's not strict heel work. I'm not trying to do an exercise, but it means loosely dog somewhere next to you sort of thing. And you're walking quite fast because it's very hard to show, you know, worry about it. And if the dog's worried, they're getting past the situation quickly as well. So we're not running, we're just fast paced walking, if you like, shoulders up high, relaxed, looking forward, or chatting quite casually to your friends next to you is the best advice for helping your dogs getting through things that they're not worried about. And you can always drop treats or when there's places where they're not so sure about, but subtly, not giving them. And also throw parties. That's what I used to Rob gave me this idea, actually. So Zippy didn't like loud noises, and also I didn't shout that much, and so when shouting happened, that used to freak her out. So he said counteract that, so shout but then throw a load of toys around, so it means nothing, so you're having a party. And that worked really well, because I don't shout at my dogs, but I do, you know, obviously shouting happens around, and she used to worry, and now she doesn't care. She got to a point where, you know, the wrappers that go around, you know, the bubble wrap?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so when that used to come in, I used to have a party with that. So I used to play tug games with it in the house with her and make it bang and throw games. And she got to a point where she loved that, whereas before, you know, just flicking the letterbox would send... She was very subtle about it. She didn't look scared. She just used to leave the room. But I didn't know that that was fear.
Yeah. And like I say, if you're kind of not looking out for those things, if you think you've got a confident dog, it's very easy to maybe miss those signals and just mistake them for something else.
Yeah, I must say, I think most people don't realise that their dog's going through it until it creates a problem, as in they won't go into this room or go and do this activity.
Yeah.
And actually, the warning signs would be there, but we didn't read them.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
But to be honest, I don't think it matters that your dog's worried. I think you should do these exercises regardless of how confident your dog is anyway. I don't think we should wait until it. I think every dog, regardless of how confident, should be faced with, you know, little challenges of playing in different environments, playing games and new places and all the time, because then you keep their confidence up.
Yeah, and like I say, it's better to prevent something than to try and fix something, because it's so much harder to fix it later on in life.
Yeah. The biggest thing I would say with people that have actually got problems is sometimes, if it's so severe, sometimes taking a break from it does do what good. Mm-hmm. So Zippy, when she had her giant shutdowns, I didn't take her training because the point is I don't want to wait for the shutdown. I don't want to help my dog get out of it. I'd rather them not go into it in the first place.
Yeah.
So quite often when she had her big shutdown, so during COVID, Zippy got so bad that she wouldn't even train on my field. And I genuinely thought she wouldn't come back and do agility again.
Oh, bless and her.
Nobody liked that planet at that time, did they?
No, oh God, no. Everyone was kind of feeling a bit uneasy.
Yeah, so how I dealt with it then is when we did start training again, I used to bring her, but even though it was her place, I trained another dog and I would just bring her. And the first few sessions, I would just leave her in her crate and she just watched. So I'm not asking her to play. I'm not asking her to do anything. And then after a few sessions, when we did that, when we did the course walking, I would bring her out on a loose lead or just let her walk and follow me. So we did that.
Oh, yeah.
And then after a few sessions, I would play in the background, not doing agility, just throwing a toy and playing. Because for her, she wouldn't even go for a ball if she felt it was all too serious.
Oh, bless her.
Yeah, and I just did it slowly. And there were times when people said, just do it. Look, she looks fine. She's playing fine. I was like, no, 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 I'm going to wait. And I was very patient with it because, as I said, I didn't want to wait for her to kick off again. I wanted to do it where she didn't even know about it herself. She was confident everywhere. And then, yeah, so that can help some people. But the biggest thing I find is, I don't know how, they know where the start line is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so, gotcha.
Yeah, so with Zippy, I quite often did her warm-up away from the arena, away from it completely in the car park. So I never took a cold dog. It looked like I did. Her warm-up was done miles away, because if I warmed up near the ring, she would think I'm trying too hard, too much pressure, and that could create a shutdown.
Yeah.
So for her, every dog's different, but for her, that's why I did that. So when I did get to the ring, I used to ignore her. And she used to get so angry trying to get my attention. She forgot about all the surroundings, all the start line, all the people, everything. And she didn't even know that she was doing agility until she was on the start line. She'd got past that barrier. Because she often, I didn't know how, I said to people, how does she know we're in the ring? Because she was calm outside. And then suddenly we passed this secret barrier. And she'd be like, I'm not happy. So that's what I did to counteract that. She didn't have a clue. She was barking behind me, desperate for my attention. And then I'd say, you ready? And then I knew I had her. She wasn't barking. I knew I didn't have her. I would leave the ring. I wouldn't even try. And the other thing I would say is, when dogs do have shutdowns, don't panic. It's okay. It's okay. It'll happen. Don't think it when you fix it, it'll never happen again. It can happen, but it doesn't mean that you've gone back to square one. It's just, you know, just like when you're as a human, you have good days and you have wobbly days. It's the same.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. And I really like that analogy. Like you say, they're just like us. Sometimes, you know, we all have days where we just don't feel like it, or we just don't feel our most confident. So, I couldn't agree more. That was amazing. Thank you. A lot of things I can apply with my own dogs, actually, as well, which is very helpful. Thank you. Next question. So this is kind of on the other end of the scale. And looking at, I've just lost my voice then. So looking at, how would you manage working cockers who get over aroused around agility?
I've got those. I've had two, three like that, actually. Crash was the biggest arousal, and I have to say, Kamau helped me with, and I didn't even know I needed help with him, actually. I went for Zippy and had him as well, and Kamau picked up on the, if you don't deal with this now, your dog will be so over aroused in a few years time, you won't get anything and he won't be listening. And it was great advice. And so basically with over arousal, it's the biggest thing that creates over arousal is overstimulation is not teaching them when to stop the game. So you quite often babysitting tugging. Have you heard of that? That's one of my bugbears. So because our dogs can be quite easily distracted, run off and do things, we shove a toy in their mouth and they're tugging while we're talking to people, or walking them out the ring, tugging till we get the lead. That to me is the fastest way to one day get a dog over aroused, because the longer they're on the toy, the more excited they get.
Yep.
And for some dogs, that can send them over the edge. Some of them, and so then they won't let go of the toy, will they? And that sort of thing, because they can't hear. So for those sort of types of dogs, I play arousal games. So those are games like, the boundary games are really good. So you want to turn them into games rather than control. So boundary games, although you're saying stay on the bed, it's a game where they they themselves try to control themselves to stay on the bed. So they're like, oh, if I stay here longer, I get a reward, rather than you dare get off, you'll get punished. It's the other way around, isn't it? It's that sort of game. Another game I play, it works a little bit of the shadow handling that I talked about earlier, but it's a very slow movement, and you give the dogs verbal command and see if they can do it. And if they just stare at you, then just move them, because that tells me that they're too excited. They've not heard you. They've not been disobedient. They just haven't heard you. They're so busy watching your movement, they couldn't hear you say. So do less movement next time, and then ask for the behaviour and see if they can do it. And eventually you'll be able to work that up till you're running around asking for behaviours, because the dogs are learning to listen. Generally speaking, the fastest way for arousal, though, is just doing too much in one session. To keep your session short, make sure your play rewards are real rewards. I love my rewarding. It's very important. But you don't need to do it more than 5 seconds, really. Mm. Like, really mean it and then stop it. This is dog dependent, though. Some dogs, you need to, like, rival my border collie. I had to build up a lot of drive. Some dogs have it naturally, and you just have to capture it, and just, you're teaching them a reward structure rather than building drive and reward structure, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, I hope I've answered it. It's very hard to scope.
Yeah, no, there's a huge kind of, you could, again, that one you could talk about for hours.
It's hard. So the one thing, well, I was going to say with Spaniels, one thing I think people, because they can be quite exuberant, I think people think they're over aroused. So it's very hard to pinpoint what people actually know arousal is. A lot of people with Spaniels, they want to control their dogs and make them calm. But they're Spaniels, and I think you've got to let them be Spaniels. And I call these grey areas, like, pick your battles with Spaniels.
Yeah.
I don't mind them jumping around and being an idiot next to me, as long as when I say, are you ready, which tells me they're about to start an exercise, I've got their full focus.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. And if I haven't got their full focus, I will play some games, like turn around my legs or a wing wrap or some hand touches just to get the focus, and then see, and then do it. So, so I think some people don't know what it is. They think their dog's jumping around that's over aroused. No, they could be just excited. So if we try and control them, that can be more frustrating and create a bigger problem later. So sometimes let Spaniels be Spaniels.
Yeah. And like I said, every time, I mean, I had a couple the other day, got your Spaniels calm. I was like, don't let him lull you into a false insecurity right now. Just because you see him on a video or you see him in a picture and he's chilled. He is not like that around a ring. I mean, a lot of people see me actually feeding him and trying to get him in focus, because otherwise he will just bark and bark and bark, which is my own fault. But
it's not necessarily, it could be just him.
That's true. Although he was mute until a year, and then at a year old,
there was crash.
And to be fair, all his relatives love to bark. So, but it comes with them. So it's something you've got to kind of, is it an arousal or is it just him?
It will be arousal, but it can be his personality. And you might have to play more arousal games to help him.
Yes.
But definitely of those dogs, I find obedience is like the worst thing you can do, because it can frustrate them. So with some arousals, it's great, because the more work, if dogs are over aroused, the more work you give them, actually the higher state they get. Arousal, really, it's about, you want to curb it. You want to be able to control it in the sense of ask them to do little amounts and then stop the behavior. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's not like you've got to release them from their control, you know, what they're doing, because otherwise they get too excited.
Yeah, and like I said, it doesn't take much, and talking from experience here with my Spaniel, doesn't take much for his little brain to tip over. As soon as you, I know certain behaviours will, if I'm trying to do obedience and stuff, certain behaviours will kind of tip him over more than others. So I think knowing your dog and knowing we'll do that is definitely,
and teaching them an end of exercise, that's so important. Yeah. Don't just, because otherwise they're like, more, and you've just walked off, and that can frustrate them. Like, let them know this exercise is now finished.
Yeah, 100%. Oh, awesome. And the next one, it kind of leads as well from that, actually. So another person was asking how you'd manage potentially a Spaniel that, in their words, bulldozes through in order to get to the path of the reward. So I'm presuming a bit of a pole knocker in this case.
Describe Crash, aptly named Crash. That was him. So for those type of dogs, generally speaking, if I'm honest, they want to see your face. So those behaviours tend to only happen when you get in front of them. because they're trying to see your face. So Crash, if I ran ahead, if I ran past him or ahead and I'm not looking and I just keep running, suddenly I will hear all the poles come crashing down. He will leave the weaves, he won't do his contacts, he'll just fly them, sort of thing, or he'll just take what's in front. And yeah, so for those, I just tell people to, once you get level or in front of them, just turn your cheek a little bit, don't stare at them, because I always believe you stare at them, you're not showing the dog where to go next, and they get you know, so they slow down, they don't know, but just a little bit so they can see your eyes and you can still see where you're going, and that usually fixes the problem literally overnight.
Oh, that's a really good idea, actually. Yeah, do you know what? I never thought about that actually.
They just want to see your eyes.
Yeah, and a lot of, like I say, a lot of what we do with the dogs is body language at the end of the day.
Yeah, and not just that, if you think of it from their point of view, if you've done a lot of toy work when they're puppies, right? You've done a lot of go get that toy and you chase next to them to create that drive, don't you? So you've put that in them ready. So now you're doing your agility and there's now equipment in between their toy that they've got to do. And you just charged off. They might see that as a race.
Yes.
So they might go, oh my god, she's trying to get the toy before me, and therefore not concentrating on the toy. Whereas when you turn your face a little bit, just a little bit, and show them the cheek, as I say it, you're saying to them, I'm still with you, I'm not racing you, we're going to the toy together, it's yours. That's basically what it's saying. Do the equipment as well, so you're showing connection the whole time for those dogs.
Awesome. No, that's a really good point. And I like what you mean there about, you know, we've taught them all this kind of racing after us. The equipment's there. That if they think it's a race, I mean, I used to joke, one of my cockapoos, she hated like agility rounds. She didn't hate them, but her contacts were never great. And part of that was my consistency because she was my first dog. But we always used to joke she loved jumping because she could just go fast and she didn't have to stop on the contacts. And so they just want to be with you, don't they?
That's what I love about them.
Amazing. This next question we've touched on a little bit, but I'm sure we can kind of look at it in its own way as well. But how would you manage sniffing in the context of agility of a spaniel? So I guess it's similar, you know, dog dependent.
This is a hard one.
Yeah,
I tell you why, because there's so many different reasons why dogs sniff.
Yes.
So yeah. So, but to be fair, they're all dealt with the same way, I think, if I'm honest.
Yep.
So you have some spaniels that sniff just because there's somebody's left cheese, or there's a fish stand, or there's a rabbit poo in the corner, and that's what you know, or wee or something. Sometimes they just want that, and it's got nothing to do with anything else. They just go, oh, do you know what? I just want to check that out. And then there's other spaniels that can sniff. They call it displacement, don't they? Where they're feeling pressure, or they think something's gone wrong, or they're a bit worried about the environment, or what's been asked of them. And so they it's like a coping mechanism, and they sort of drop their head. So there's that reason as well. But basically speaking, I would say the way to deal with it is the same almost. So with the first one, the distraction game. So I do a lot when they're puppies. I always do it as well, where any sort of game, anything I do, like playing with a toy, I work with distraction. So when they're youngsters, once I've got them into a toy, I will increase the distractions. And if I can't, I'll just simply tap or make a noise next to me whilst they're playing. So I'm creating my own distraction to keep them focused on the toy.
Yeah.
So that helps with those. And with the food sniffers, it will eventually come to a point where I'd ask them to do some simple behaviours like heel work or playing with a toy or chase me. And they'll be like food containers that they haven't got food in them, but they've got the scent of food and that sort of thing. The thing is, I think we have to respect our breed, if you like.
Yes.
They are quite, I'll be honest, they are manipulative. They're very clever and they know what they want. And they can be quite, some of them can be very strong-minded and strong-willed. Mm. That doesn't mean that they're bad dogs. It just means that we should do more distraction training than, say, other people's dogs that don't have any of those problems. Mm. You know, and I would do a lot of that when they're young. In fact, all dogs, regardless of breed, I do that with, because if my dog can play with me amongst a war going off, or, you know, a busy concert or whatever, then they'll do anything, won't they? Because agility is just a game. It's not just, you know, toy play is the same as jumping a jump. You've added value to it. They want to do it. They want to play over toy. So it's the same thing to me. So I think everybody should work around so much distraction games when they're young. Just start small and then build it up and keep it up forever. And for the reason for displacement, the only thing I would change there, I still play those games, but the only thing I change there is the way I train. I used to say I train different from other people, but I'm not sure that's the case now, which is kind of exciting and fun. My form of training is, I don't like the dogs to know they've gone wrong when they're doing agility training.
Yeah,
it's not, you know, so a lot of my training is quite fun based because they don't know necessarily they've gone wrong. I like to keep going. It doesn't mean I certainly don't throw a toy in. So say I've asked for a jump and they've just bombed into the tunnel. I don't throw a toy as they leave the tunnel. That's not how I do it. Because, you know, what if they heard the jump halfway in the tunnel and suddenly they get a reward straight after? And then I'm throwing a toy in and they're like, oh, maybe the jump command also means tunnel. So I don't do that. But what I do is I ignore the fact that they've gone into the tunnel and I'll do something afterwards, which is correct.
Yeah.
And I'll reward that.
Yeah, oh, gotcha. And I think that's a really good point there as well. Like, a lot of the time, especially I'm assuming with course running and things like that, sometimes I always live with the idea that it's never my dog's fault. Oh, 99.9% of the time, it's never their fault. It's my fault.
It's 100% your fault because if they did something wrong, you know it's their fault. It's because of your lack of training.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, what I say.
Yeah.
And also, they're not machines, are they? They're dogs. No, the same as us. Yeah. We make mistakes, they make mistakes.
Oh, God, yeah. I think sometimes it's very, people can see them as robots and you know, they've got to, if I've taught them this and they should know it, but you know, in this circumstance on this day and with this kind of environment, they just couldn't, they just didn't. So I think that's really, really important to highlight. Awesome. So we have last two questions. I could talk all day about Spaniels, but I'm sure we've got to wrap it up at some point. So question 9 and 10, I'll do them together. So, what's the best and worst part about owning and training a Spaniel? And if you could only have one colour of Spaniel, which would it be?
Well, that last question is the easy one. So cover your ears, Crash. My favourite colour is liver. And the reason is, I mean, I love golden as well, actually. But I love the colour golden. I'm not sure I'm a fan of golden Spaniels. I don't know. I don't know if it's a colour thing, but everyone I've met, bar a couple, they seem to be a bit quirky. I don't know. I don't know if it's to do with the gene or it's just, you know, the Spaniels I've met. I don't know. But anyway, but liver is easy the best because you can put on any colour and it looks cool. And who doesn't like anything that looks like chocolate?
Oh, God, yeah, 100%. Yeah. And I
love my black Spaniels, but you can't take photographs. It's really hard to take photographs. So as for the other, sorry, what was the other question?
The other question was, what's the best and worst parts about owning and training a Spaniel?
The best part is their Pandora's box. You don't know what you're going to get. Every Spaniel I've ever met is totally different to another Spaniel. You think you've got this curriculum, you've got this set way of, I'm going to train it. I throw it out the window. You always train the dog in front of you.
Yeah.
They'll throw up things that are new, bring in things that you've never seen, surprise you with things. That's what I love about Spaniels. there are lots of breeds that I'd love to run in small and medium, but I'd never own one because I just love my Spaniels too much and they're in the same height category. I love like the Pyrenees. I nearly had a Pyrenee I just love those challenge. I'm not saying they're challenging, but I generally love challenging, fun dogs to be around that have full of character. So so the Pyrenees I really liked. That's why I had a Beagle. I didn't have a Beagle for agility. I had a Beagle as a pet. The Pat Cross Collie, I've trained quite a few of them. They're amazing. Yeah. I just love their personality. But they're in the height category of a Spaniel, so it won't happen. I'm not done with Spaniels yet. I love them too much. The worst part... Well, I'll be honest with you, the worst part is always going to be distraction training, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because who doesn't like playing with a dog that doesn't want to play with you?
Yeah.
So I hate that part the most, but I will do it the most. That's the most training. Yeah. I'll turn it into games, but that's the training I do the most because it's so important. And you can do it in a fun way. But and the other thing, I think the hardest thing about having a Spaniel really is when you go abroad or go away and you want people to look after them, you know that some of them might be fuller characters and that's a big ask. So I guess that's not a nice thing.
Yeah.
Luckily, I've got good friends.
Oh, God, yeah. You need to surround yourself with Spaniel friends, because I've got a few. I know if I ever needed them looking after, I know they'd be okay. But if I asked my non-Spaniel friends, I think they would have to go, oh, I don't know if I could cope with him for a week. But yeah.
And you have to have like, you almost feel like saying sorry first.
Yeah. You have to buy a care package just to say in advance, I'm sorry for what might happen. I don't know what they'll throw at you, but they'll find something. No,
but I love how full of energy they are, how impulsive they can be, how different they can be. And, you know, and they're just there, they show their character and personality on their faces so well. I love that.
Oh, God, they're so expressionate. In fact, there's a picture at the moment that's surfacing of one of my Spaniels from last year at KCI, and it's on a couple of articles at the moment, and he's just got this huge smile on his face halfway over this jump, and it's ridiculous. I mean, the grins he pulls, it's just you just think, oh God. But I mean, he's photogenic, but it wasn't his best picture, but he's just got this huge smile on his face. So I think they're very happy. I must admit, they're pretty happy majority of the time, I would say. And I think what else was I gonna say about them? They're the most, I would say they're up for anything. I mean, you could get them up. I mean, I know mine, if it was midnight and I said, let's go for a walk, you'd be like, oh, heck yeah. Yeah, I'll go for a walk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's easy. But saying that, that's a double-edged sword. It's very easy to over-exercise and overstimulate a Spaniel, I think. Because we think they need more. And all you do is just train them into what they think is acceptable.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And also going along that actually helps with the training thing. I think some people don't know when to stop. And I must admit, a little thing I do, which I know it's a bit sad and geeky, but I'm just going to say it. when I play my games and train my dogs, I always put a timer on my watch. And it is dog dependent, but it never, if I'm doing my own one-to-one training, it never goes above 5 minutes for a Spaniel. And that includes reward time. Because those keen ones, it's so easy to keep going, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you don't know that they're fatigued. You don't know mentally fatigued. And then you could be ruining something you don't realise.
Oh, God, yeah. Because I think they would keep going for as long as you wanted them to. But at the end of the day, it's not a useful thing for them. And like I say, their brains, you can easily fry them out before they've had...
And you won't know. It's just what you're asking of them is too hard and they keep going wrong. And then you get frustrated. If you'd stopped earlier, it wouldn't have happened at all.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Because physically, they could go for days. I mean, I did Helvellyn, having never done a mountain before, my Spaniel. He did eight or 10 hours on that mountain and he came back and he's still fighting sleep.
Wow, he's a machine. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he must have done about two lots of that mountain because he did lots of coming back and forth and whizzing around. So, but physically, they could go forever. But mentally, like you say, they just need you to be mindful of them for that reason. Awesome. No, I think this has been so jam-packed with so much information. I mean, I can't thank you enough for sharing your expertise, and there's so much I can take and apply to my own dog. So for that, I must say a huge thank you.
No problem.
And I'm sure this will be a very helpful episode, even for people who don't have Spaniels, actually, because I think there's a lot of info in there that's useful and helpful for other breeds and whatnot. So thank you so much.
No problem.
And just to close as well, you've got some exciting things coming up, and obviously one of those is the Paws Made Day, which is a training day that's been put on by Paws Trading. So I don't know if you want to mention a bit about kind of what Paws Trading do, because I know they do them they've done them every year for the last couple, but
it's their way of giving back.
Yeah, I mean,
they've been in the middle of our agility community for as long as I've done it, I think. Since I started, actually. Mm-hmm. And they're there for people and they want to help people. And I think they're also thankful for everybody supporting them. And it's their way of giving back every year, isn't it?
Yeah.
And also, you get to try out some cool paws made, because they make their own toys as well. And you get to try out their cool paws made toys. And I'm looking forward to it.
I always like, even when I haven't been, I always like to watch the content and see how what everyone's doing, and it's like I say, it's just a nice thank you that they give back to the agility community. So that's really lovely.
It's a competition that they run, and people can win it, so no one's paid to be there, and I think that's it's a nice thing, and it's going to be good. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, God, I think it'll be a really nice one for people. And I know they've picked this year's winners, so anyone that missed out this year is going to have to look for next year and keep an eye out on their page. But they do lots of different things as well. And I don't know if you've got anything in terms of online training or any training camps or days coming up that you want to share.
Well, I must admit, I've only become self-employed, I'd say, at this September last year, I think.
Oh,
I started. I was new at it. Yeah, I used to have a normal humdrum job. I've been training for years, but it was very quiet and just, you know, in my own time. But now I've gone full time, so I've only just started, and I must admit, I'm pretty bad at messaging. I think people know that, because I need an admin, really. But I do have a Facebook page, Daimonic Devils Dog Training. And I hope, because I've only just started, I'm doing some camps and training days, and I think they're found on the available, is it the Facebook available training days?
Yes.
So sometimes they're listed there. So I do travel around at the moment. And I haven't got any online training, but I mean, watch this space. Once I sort out my admin. Yeah, I would like to, because, I would like to help. I like to help a lot more people than I can at the moment. It's always good to share information and be part of more people's journeys when they're bringing up their dogs.
Yeah, 100%. And for anyone that's interested, I'll leave a link to your Facebook page as well in the show notes. So if anyone wants to contact you for more information or any kind of sort of training going forward, they can find you there. So thank you so much, Sam, for all your time and your expertise.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sam.